Even small actions have consequences. And while we can often choose our actions, we rarely get to choose our consequences.
Welcome to the Busy Girls Book Club. We are bringing you all of the books you see on social media that everyone's shoving down your throat, and we read them so you don't have to, and let you know if they're worth your time. I'm Caitlin.
I'm Casey.
And I'm Catherine. And this week we are bringing you a book that kind of is a sleeper agent that shows up every once in a while on Book Talk. And it is something you would never expect almost as you read it. It is Tress of the Emerald Sea, and it is a sci-fi fantasy question mark book that is, I just learned, using storytelling techniques from The Princess Bride. And it is part of a larger universe as well, which I also learned from Caitlin. So it is by Brandon Sanderson, who writes many, many books in this universe. It's the Cosmer universe.
And if Catherine had read his note in the back of the book, she would already know all of this.
Yeah.
Also on Goodreads, once it's part of the Cosmer universe.
Yeah. But once it said the end, I ended, because that's how you do. But anyway, I'm here to tell you about the book and summarize the book. So basically, it starts off with this pretty unassuming girl who's just living life on this uninhabitable rock that people inhabit that more or less is trying to kill them. It's surrounded by spores that grow vines when attached to water. And if you took a biology class, you know that humans are over 70% water. So yeah, these spores can definitely kill you. And they're based on these moons and the system and the planet that they surround. And she kind of lives a life in semi-poverty, but she's pretty happy and content. And she washes windows for a duke and his family that are kind of the royal family of the island. And she falls in love with the duke's son, who's trying to pretend that he's not the duke's son, but he definitely is. And it's pretty obvious. And Tress knows that from the beginning. So she's not an idiot. And the Duke decides, when he sees that their connection is growing a little too close, to bring his son on a royal tour to get him a bride. And he resists and resists and resists until he finally gives up on his son and takes another as his heir and sends his son off to an evil sorceress to never be seen again. Well, Tress decides that her unassuming life is no longer what she wants, and she goes off on an adventure to save her love, Charlie. And that's where the book kind of takes off from there.
Let me tell you, too, the opening lines are like talking about a girl named Glorf, but people call her Tress. And I was like, where are we going?
Yeah. I was like, Glorf, what is going on?
Yes.
It's a ride.
It is. It's a very interesting universe. But do you guys have your reviews?
I can go first. I have a 5-star review. It's so good and wholesome. It's a sweet, wonderful story about a girl who leaves her island for an adventure. I couldn't stop giggling and smiling. The chapters are so short, it kept saying, oh, just one more chapter, until I couldn't keep my eyes open any longer. Between the plot of this cozy adventure are passages about life and becoming, a welcome read for even the most cynical among us. I thought that one was kind of inspirational.
Thank you. Okay, I can go next. I have two. The first one is a 1-star. I'm very curious to see y'all's reaction to this review. No, it's not the worst book I ever read, but somehow Fourth Wing was more enjoyable, and I gave that 2 stars. So,
on behalf of every reader on earth, I'm offended.
So obviously that person has horrible taste, but
yeah, have fun reading Secret History and A Little Life.
Okay, next review. 3-star review. Ugh, I'm annoyed at myself for being such a hater all the time.
Is that it?
Casey?
No.
That's you.
That's why I read it. I was like, I relate to this sentiment like so emphatically, so much. It's part of a longer review, but that's like the funny part. So I'm just gonna stop.
Oh my God, that is funny. Okay, well, I'll go last. I found a 2-star review on Goodreads, and it says, "It's unfortunate I had to discover I don't like cozy fantasy from Brandon Sanderson. I thought this was an absolute drag, and I so badly wanted to DNF it."
Damn.
Oh, hey, we read a 1, a 2, a 3, and a 5-star review. I think that's the most diverse we've ever been.
I think it is.
Well, this is a very highly reviewed book. The Goodreads rating is 4.5 out of 5, and the Amazon rating is 4.7 out of 5. What do you guys think?
I landed on a solid 4. I thought it was witty and whimsical and cozy. I liked the main character and a lot of the people she meets along the way. I found the end kind of confusing, I think, because I have not read other Cosmere books. And I also predicted the biggest plot twist in the whole book. And I was like,
I'm upset. Well. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's 4 stars for me. Otherwise, I thought it was really funny and I enjoyed the writing and the characters and the world. I enjoyed it.
I'll go next. I agree. I enjoyed the world because I thought it was unlike I've read anything ever. Like, very interesting about the moons and the spores and the different biomes, almost because of the different moons. But I gave it 3 stars, and that is like the highest I'll give it. I won't even give it a 3.5. It is. I am not the demographic for this book. I really thought this was YA. Apparently, it's not. People are trying to convince me it's not. It reads like YA. I totally was lost on the narrator and the narrative. I didn't love all the fourth wall breaks. I just kind of was begrudgingly getting through it. I was closer to the 2-star review I read, where I just wasn't a cozy fantasy person. And here's the thing. I love The Princess Bride. That was like my favorite childhood movie. I did not feel Princess Bride vibes. But maybe that's because trying to recreate a masterpiece is never a good idea.
Okay, so I'm not like a huge Princess Bride fan, so maybe that's the difference.
See, Mike, yeah. I actually hated The Princess Bride.
Yeah, I used to be terrified of it as a child, by the way, those rat things.
Oh, really? I watched it every day almost for like months.
Was not my jam.
Well, I'm feeling very satisfied because today I'm not the hater. I'm giving it 4 stars.
You manifested that with your review.
I did. I think I do love a cozy fantasy. I love a fairy tale. The story is told like very much in the fairy tale narrative tradition. I always love books like that. I also always love a princess saving the prince narrative, which this hits both of those notes for me. I also think it's a great mix of traditional fairy tale storytelling and really inventive and creative world building. So, however, I didn't think it was perfect. It's 4 stars, not 5 for me. There were times when like the world was like a little confusing. There were times when I felt like the jokes didn't totally land, and I did get the twist like so early. But to me, it was like a 6 Crimson Cranes read where I just like really enjoyed it.
Cozy, both of those.
Cozy, yep. Cozy and wholesome.
Not to Catherine, but...
Here's the thing. If I was given more time to read it, or I was not in a reading slump, I'll fully disclose I'm in a bit of a reading slump. All you readers totally understand that there are moments where you just don't really want to read after a book that's like super long. For me, it was A Little Life. I really didn't want to read after A Little Life. So I feel like my review would be different maybe if I wasn't reading this after A Little Life and I wasn't kind of on a crunch or a deadline and I could just truly cozy read it.
Okay, Catherine, you can just be a hater.
Fair enough. I'm just a hater.
I'm out fists swinging like me. Like.
Okay.
Unapologetic.
Yeah.
I'll try.
Okay. Well, our non-spoiler discussion questions. Is it more plot or character driven?
This is hard because there is a definite plot and there's definitely goal in mind, but the character is super important of Tress. to move the story along and her growing. But I think I'm going to land on plot driven just because she has like a definite goal in mind of saving Charlie and saving the Duke's son. And there is a lot happening to her and going on in the storyline. And she doesn't really totally control the narrative until the end.
I agree with all those points. However, I think I'm going to lean character driven because there are multiple opportunities where she can just like not participate anymore. And because she is developing along the way, she keeps going. I'm like very almost like in the middle, but I'm leaning character just because it is Tress who makes these important decisions to, you know, go on these kind of diverging paths to get to her end goal.
That's a good argument. I initially was leaning plot because I do agree with you, Catherine. Like, there's definitely a lot that's out of Tress's control. But Caitlin, you kind of convinced me a little bit because she has multiple like off ramps in the book and she chooses to keep going. And like one of the central points in the book is that Tress learns to stop being such a people pleaser and like kind of become more self-actualized and like take charge. And that's basically, and she's so smart. I love all her little like hijinks to like solve the problems. But I think I'm pretty close to 50-50 too.
Oh, it's definitely 50-50 because it's interesting because we don't get into Tress's mind really at all because the narrator is not Tress, which may surprise some people.
It surprised me.
It surprised me too. And there are moments where it takes you out of it a bit because there's moments where they don't even talk about Tress. They talk about their own personal experience, the narrator. So it's interesting because it feels very plot in those moments because it's this narrator telling the story in a past tense. And so you know that the story ends well throughout it because of that. But at the same time, you're just kind of like, oh, it's because the plot is going along. But I like your argument, Caitlin, about she has a lot of moments where she could just be like, nah, I'm done. Like, I could leave at any moment. And she's very, very smart. And it's obvious to everyone around her that she's the smartest person in the room.
Yeah. An interesting question. Have you ever read other books by the author? This is our first Brandon Sanderson book on the podcast, but he is a very popular fantasy writer who has written, oh my gosh, a lot of books. This, however, is my first read by him.
I was always like, oh, Brandon Sanderson's that boy fantasy writer. Like, I always think of his books as boy fantasy, you know, and we tend to read girl fantasy. However, I actually realized I have recommended one of his books on the podcast before.
Oh.
I was reading the books at the front, like, of this one, of other books he wrote. I one time recommended a very strange sounding book, which now 1 + 1 = 2, called Alcatraz versus the Evil Librarians, which is like a middle grade series. And now that I have connected that that is the same person, it makes sense. It's written the exact same way. But I recommended it on the podcast. So apparently I guess I like his books. I don't know.
That makes so much sense that he writes middle grade.
I think that's his only middle grade.
Yeah, I think most of his books are adult.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. It says on Goodreads. Now, to be fair, you can create many editions of the same book and they count as unique editions. But according to Goodreads, he has 428 distinct works.
I did watch a TikTok recently that was like, oh, hey, you should read Brandon Sanderson. And someone hands a book. And then she like also plays Brandon Sanderson. And like as she starts to crack the book, he like tosses two more at her. And then she turns a page and he tosses like three more books at her because he writes them so fast. It was like a joke about it.
And also, according to Goodreads, the Cosmere series, which is allegedly where Tress and the Emerald Sea is, has about 20 books in it.
Yeah, good luck. Like, I'm intrigued, but also intimidated. I think that's why we've also never tackled his books before, is because, like, where do you start? But I also saw comments online that were like, if you want to start into the world of Brandon Sanderson, Tress is like the perfect entry book.
Interesting.
Like from big fans that were saying that, who had read many of his books.
I do know that he has series within this universe. This is one of his only standalones. So even this book, even though this book is in the same universe as other books of his, it is not as connected to them, like through characters, you know, to my knowledge. You don't have to read any of the other books to read this one. So I saw the same thing just because it's like one of his only standalones. It's one of the easiest ways to get into it.
It definitely had a finality of the ending. Like, it didn't feel like I needed to read more books to understand the story.
Right.
And for our listeners, if you like read the intro to the book or like the end of the book, he was writing this just kind of on his own, I think during COVID, basically as like a fairy tale for his wife. And he kind of, he did base, like he thought, oh, if Princess Bride, what if Buttercup went to find Wesley? It kind of wrote it that way. So he didn't totally plan on like maybe publishing this, and then he did.
Yeah. What about pacing? Personally, I know Catherine doesn't feel the same. I blew through this book. I was worried I wasn't going to finish in time because I'm perpetually behind, but I ended up reading it really fast. I think I read it in 3 days, but that's like with not that many reading hours each day.
I, surprisingly, Casey, it was a really quick read. And the pacing was actually pretty good. My issue is I procrastinated. And when I started the book, like a couple of days ago before reading this, to listeners, to be fair, I literally finished this 5 minutes before we started recording. So I pulled a Casey on this one and finished it very, very soon before
Savage.
We recorded. I know. I read 80% of this book in one day because I needed to finish it before this podcast recording. If I had time managed better, I could have read this in a more manageable way. It is a very quick read and a very well-paced read. I kind of wish I read it when I was in a better headspace for reading. Thank you, A Little Life, for fucking with my brain.
We're all still recovering from A Little Life, and I think I've read like four books since then, so.
Yeah. Also, Catherine didn't realize we were recording today, which is also called pulling a Casey.
Mm-hmm. Well, so props to her for like, we're like, so you want to record tonight? And she's like, hold on, let me read the whole book.
So like, pretty much, yeah. Again, I was only about 100 pages in, if that.
And it's over 300, yeah. Goodreads said, for me, it took me almost a week. I've been very busy and was purposely reading it in whatever spare time I had. Finished it first somehow, just because I was reading ahead on the list. So
good for you. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it was easy to pick up and put down.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you couldn't tell, Caitlin is the good podcast host who actually reads ahead and doesn't procrastinate.
Yeah.
Because I get stressed when I look at how long our list of books is, and I need to just continue making progress.
It never ends. We're always waiting for y'all. Okay. Well, would you watch a movie or TV show about the book?
Maybe a movie. Maybe.
I think it can be a fun animated.
Ooh, yes. 100%.
Okay, Studio Ghibli?
Studio Ghibli, okay, for sure.
Someone said it gave Howl's Moving Castle vibes.
Yes.
It totally does.
Oh, it's totally a Studio Ghibli. Pick it up immediately.
Yeah, that makes me fall in love with it, actually, to imagine how everything looks in like Studio Ghibli style. I'm just like, oh, and all the plants bursting forth and the moon.
There's just so many colors, and animated would be the way to go.
Trying to imagine a live action version of this almost ruins it.
Like, I'd definitely watch it if it was like an animated movie or TV series.
Too. Oh, yeah.
Especially because I think it has to be very lighthearted. And I think if it were live action, it just wouldn't have the same feel. Because the one hang up is that I think you would have to just not explain so much about how the world works and then just be like, you get it, just accept it. And
you know, if you were going to do a live action, which I wouldn't recommend, you would have to almost give Ella Enchanted vibes and have like a true outside narrator. You don't Ella Enchanted?
No. I think you'd have to do that even in the animated. It would just work better with a little narration voice popping in every now and then.
Well, especially because Hoyd, the narrator,
is also a character
in the story. Like you would have to almost like flashback freeze frame and have him like be there and not, and then talking to the audience.
You just like switch to narration voice while she's doing something. I don't know. Hey, hire us. We can make this work.
Can we?
Studio, we'll do the script. You hit the animation. Dream movie.
Yeah, my best thing was record scratch freeze frame.
And this is you might be wondering how I got here.
Yeah.
Honestly though,
it's kind of that vibe
every week. Yeah, okay. All right, anyway, we're moving on to our busy girl rating now.
I stand my quality reading and give it a 4. I think it is well-paced and digestible bits. It just takes a hot second to get into it. And if you're not a fantasy person and don't remotely like sci-fi even a little bit, it's probably not the book for you. But otherwise, I think like anyone of any age could easily pick this up.
Oh, yeah. No, it's... There is no age discrimination in this book because, I mean, I thought it was written for middle schoolers, not going to lie, which I am sorely wrong. So, yeah, it's for everyone. I would also give it a 4, even though I gave it a 3 in quality rating. I think it is a quicker book. But like Caitlin said, it does get knocks for being kind of not a welcoming fantasy book, if that makes any sense. Like, I think you have to be fairly interested in the fantasy genre and wanting to read more cozier fantasy in order to be interested, because it's not even really fantasy, it's more sci-fi, and sci-fi can be a little hard to get into, not gonna lie. So you really have to be willing to read that kind of book in order to be interested in it, because it does take a hot minute to get into it.
Yeah, I'm gonna agree. I'm gonna give it a 4. What keeps it from a 5 for me is that even though I thought the pacing was good, the pacing is pretty steady the whole time. So it's also not a really fast paced book. But it's easy to pick up and put down. It's a nice, enjoyable read. So it's a 4.
So that wraps up our normal non-spoiler discussion. So let's get to the spoiler alert section.
So the narrator of this book is Hoyd, who we don't meet at first. It's kind of set up initially like a typical fairy tale, anonymous, removed narrator. You later find out kind of like a third of the way through the book that the narrator is actually in the book in the form of a cursed imbecile.
That's a great way to describe
explanation.
Him. Yeah.
So yeah, what did you guys think of that? He breaks the fourth wall, which is kind of a controversial thing. What did you guys think?
I was really confused about how he was omniscient. But then the more I read, I was like, oh, this is probably the only reasonable excuse for an omniscient narrator that is present in the book and isn't the main character. confusing. Yes. Mm-hmm. I didn't mind it, but it was jarring at times.
I agree. This is where I get a little far. Like, this is where my star rating happened to be knocked down to a 3. Is I didn't mind Hoyd being the narrator. And I didn't mind some of the fourth wall breaks. Some of them I thought were relevant and actually compelling. Some in the form of like parentheticals and like when things were in like little like quotation marks and parentheses and stuff like that, where it was just kind of like random tidbits that he was thinking as an imbecile, or just like it felt jarring at times and felt like moments where I got taken out of the book and out of the storyline because it almost felt like he was inserting himself into Tress's story. And I'm like, I get you're there. Yeah, I get you're there, but there are moments when you're not there that you don't need to do this.
I kind of thought that stuff was funny, and that's why I think it was kind of cozy, and it gave very like, what's that, maybe like bedtime stories where it's kind of like, or like, you know, like a Christmas movie where it's like, and this was happening, you know, like it'll pull you out sometimes. I don't know. I thought it, while it was jarring, I didn't dislike it. But so, I guess you did.
Moments.
I just kind of went with it, to be honest, and it didn't totally bother me. I do agree there were points when, like, sometimes the jokes are taken just, like, a little too far, and it's, like, maybe one too many joke, and it's kind of like, okay, let's get back to it. But I kind of got it just because you come to understand that Hoyt is, like, basically, like, a professional storyteller, and so I kind of just, like, rolled with it from the perspective of, like, this guy is kind of, like, in the fairy tale, like, orator tradition of, like, kind of telling a tall tale where, like, you know, someone who is a storyteller is just tells the fairy tale as if they know every detail. And so I just kind of accepted it. I honestly, it didn't bother me that much. I just kind of went with it. I don't think it was totally necessary, but it also didn't bother me that he was the method of telling the story.
Yeah. The moments where I really loved it was when he was like, the reason why I connected with Tress is because I felt that she was better than most heroes of stories, that she thought that she was smart, that she, like, when he was almost recognizing Tress's difference to other storytelling and other heroes and stories, that's when I really loved the fourth wall break of just like, normal heroes and stories don't stop to think about the damages that they cause. Normal heroes and stories don't think about their next steps, but Tress did, and she saw things that others didn't. That's when I loved it, because I was like, oh my God, that's so, it's so different from traditional fairy tale storytelling. And it also brings a very modern flair to a fairy tale. Of like, this is a woman who thinks 12 steps ahead, is not your traditional hero, but also is so much smarter than everyone else and really is an introverted person who can think through things better than a traditional hero in the sense would. And that's when I liked it. The moments where I didn't like it, where I was like, he was talking about like straining pasta through a sock, or he was like, where it was just like jokes where I was like, you know, didn't really need to be there. Not necessary.
Yeah, I giggle hearing her describe it. So,
so what did you guys think about the world building?
For how complex the world was, I thought it was described like pretty well, and it was completely unique. I have never read anything like this world. I want to read more in this world because now I'm like, what do all the other spores do? I gotta know all this stuff. Yeah, I enjoyed the world building. I thought it wasn't written to be too complicated. You got pieces as you needed it.
Yeah, no, the world building is completely unique. Like the idea of these moons that like, oh my God, orbit, that's the word I was trying to think of, orbit the planet and cause these spores to come down that have almost minds of their own, but also are very dangerous. And they inhabit different biomes. And it's a very interesting, unlike I've ever read in fantasy sci-fi. I thought it was a very good world building for the very like insular story. It does make me wonder almost like outside of this planet, because they mention at times outside of the planet and like other characters coming from other planets and other worlds. And it's very like surface level in those descriptions. And it made me really curious about those and wanting more depth in those. That's where I felt like it could reach a little bit more. But for the insular story itself, very good world building.
Yeah, Catherine, I have a very similar reaction to you. I think this world has some real strengths, like you guys have already mentioned. It's unique, it's vibrant, it's colorful, it's dangerous. Like, it's really fascinating, and it's the rules of the world are very well established, and they come into play quite often. So it's like the danger the world presents to humans is so constantly present that it's constantly like a factor in every conflict, which I think is great. However, at times I did find it a little difficult to understand, especially when Tress starts experimenting with all the different types of spores. I was kind of like, what is going on? The black spores, where she like has this mind connection to it and then like explores the world through her little black blob. I was like, I'm sorry, what the fuck? Also, I felt the same because a lot of the characters are actually from different worlds in their solar system. I was frequently like, what is the deal with the rest of the world? And I think it actually made the world feel very small. I understand that he did that likely because if you've read his other books, you probably get those references. Unfortunately, I've already sold my soul to SJM. I don't know that I can pick up another book universe, but I think those references had the effect of like almost negating how big and complicated her world was, because it makes you wonder about the others. And like, I didn't love it.
Oh my God, facts. Literally, your thought process made me think, like, how did they get there? Because like, they talk about at the end, the sorceress leaves the planet and then there's a picture of a rocket zooming off, and then she has laptops apparently. And I'm like, when did they get this sentient technology? How did they get there? How do other people get there?
They were a simple planet, and that's why it was cozy, but they didn't realize they had these outside forces that were in
front of them. Yeah, but then it made me think, how did the outside forces get there? How did they
all get
there?
That's how he gets you into the rest of it. I did Google, Hoid, the narrator, is mentioned in at least 9 books by Brandon Sanderson.
That was my theory. I didn't want to say it because I was like, I didn't want to look it up, and I probably... You know, I would read other books, but I don't know if I'll read the entire universe. I was like,
writing books based on, like, with Hoid's story coming up.
Mm-hmm.
But Hoid has apparently been mentioned other times and is immortal.
No, that was my whole theory, is I bet Hoid is the string that attaches all the books. Not that he's, like, in every book, but that, like, there's at least one mention of him in every book.
Yeah, I could totally see that. Here's my issue. Like, I totally agree that it entices you a little bit into reading other books, but it didn't really entice me to read other books. It made me frustrated not knowing in this book at
it
times.
It only made me frustrated at the end when the sorceress left and they seemed to know who each other was. And then he started glowing. I was like, why is he glowing? He was like, this is my thing the whole time. I was like, what thing? So I just kind of had to gloss over that part, and that's part of the reason I docked one of the stars, is because at the end I was like, whoa, I didn't have this info.
Yeah, I think it negates the standalone concept a little bit, but also I get it, and you want to sell books and you want people to read your other books, so.
Of course, he didn't originally intend to publish this one, so I don't know, maybe he just really likes Hoid.
No, this is like a Court of Thorns and Roses. He's using this as his gateway drug, I'm telling you.
I don't know.
Anyway, moving on. So the cup collection ends up being sort of a symbol for like Tress's development. She's a simple girl. She has simple desires, and the cups are her whole world. And Charlie is the one who buys her the cups. So actually also kind of a symbol of like, he gives her something she really values. By the end of the book, she doesn't care so much about the cups. And, you know, she kind of creates her own inventions. She becomes more of a self-actualized, independent person. And then, like, she doesn't really depend on Charlie anymore to, like, bring her one of the only interesting things that she values in her life. What did you guys think about that?
At first, I was like, you've got Glorf sitting on her stoop with her cup collection. I was like, I don't know. but it kind of like the cups reappeared and she started to view them differently each time they appeared and place value on certain ones for certain reasons and realized that like she used them as her way of envisioning the world outside of her. And then she realized she'd seen beyond whatever the cups could bring her. And it was really, I don't know, random character point, but worked in the end.
Yeah, it was a thread throughout the entire novel that you don't expect. Like, it starts off with the cups are this gateway to other worlds for her, even though she is like unable to leave her world because her world has like this tariff system where you can't leave if you're a resident unless you're royal. So there was no way she was ever going to leave the world, even though every reader on the planet knows that she's going to leave the world. It's just what's going to happen. And then I liked that her favorite cup symboled a butterfly. And that's kind of like this metamorphosis almost. And it's this metaphor of her changing and evolving. And they even mention it. Hoyd mentions it at the end where she's like, Tress has changed so much that how could she truly love Charlie? Like when the sorceress has like this fake version of Charlie, like how could she truly love Charlie when he hasn't changed and she's changed so much? And that's when she kind of realizes this isn't the same Charlie. And that's when she realizes like the rat Huck is Charlie, because she's like, there's no way that this person could remain the same after being held captive for like a year almost. And like, I've changed so much. There's no way he hasn't changed so much. And that's when she kind of figures like, oh my God, this person that's trying to prevent me from getting to her, but also at the same time helping me. And it's like, it's an interesting way of her realizing. And I think it's very interesting that the sorceress asks for the cups in return for taking her fake Charlie off the island. It's very much the symbol of their love, but also a symbol of her change and growth. So I think the cup collection is actually a very interesting tool for character development.
At the beginning, she's so obsessed with her cup collection. She like puts it in a bag and brings it with her on this adventure. And you're like, girl, why are you bringing teacups with you? And then at the end, the sorceress wants them. And she's like, sure, take them. Because she's realized like there are stories beyond what the cups can tell. And it was cute.
She realizes they're just cups. They're just objects. She has people and stories and she's grown past them. But that leads nicely into the next question, which is Tress and Charlie's love story.
I don't know if this is an unpopular opinion. It may be. This is arguably the least interesting part of the entire story.
No, that's not unpopular. It's totally true.
I agree. So here's why I like it and I'll defend it. It
didn't say I didn't like it. Okay. The least interesting.
It is definitely the least interesting. I like it because it still fits into this, like the fairy tale theme, the fairy tale elements. If this was not like a very traditionally rooted in fairy tale story, I wouldn't like it. But it is clearly still like that character arc and that story arc of like there is a battle and a journey and then happily ever after. And so I was like, of course, we all know this is going to end in happily ever after. And that was fine for me in this story.
It was there at the beginning. And then I was there at the end and I was like, girl, you've lived so much life in between. But also she did sit there and reevaluate throughout the book. Like, should I still be doing this? Do I know him anymore? So I was like, okay.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it was a very realistic fairy tale love story, as realistic as you can get with a fairy tale love story.
Yeah.
But also the fact that like he was there throughout, even if you didn't realize
Yes.
And we all knew. Let's be real.
Yeah, it was not.
Should we discuss that we knew that the rat truck?
I was like,
was Charlie?
You like met the rat, and they were talking about curses. As soon as they talked about curses, I was like, haha, what if Charlie's the rat? And then I was like, damn it.
I had the exact same experience.
Same.
I can't remember exactly what the scene was, but yeah, he was like running around. With her, and he was, I don't know, he said something about you're so good or something, and I was like, oh, that rat's Charlie.
Yeah,
and then I was like, oh, that rat is Charlie.
Yeah,
and then he was actively lying to her about like his family and his like status as a familiar. And I'm like, okay, it's definitely Charlie. That just confirms that he's able to lie about his lineage and origin.
Well, there are things he just knew a little too much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I was like, And then Hoyd was talking about the curse and how he couldn't talk about the curse. I was like,
yeah, too many mentions of curses to not think that the rat was Charlie. And like Huck, Chuck, Charlie.
Here, hey, would you rather be cursed like Hoyd or be cursed like Charlie?
Charlie, for Charlie, sure. I would hate to have the mind of Hoyd.
Because Charlie still had a normal brain. He could talk even. He wasn't just a smart rat. He was a rat that could articulate himself. And I would way rather that than be a person with no fucking brain. Like,
and he was eating his toes. Like, no.
Yeah. The fact that he could not focus on a single line of concentration, like concentrated thought, was so infuriating.
It was infuriating, but then he'd be like, but you have everything you need. Mm-hmm. And I have sparkly underpants or whatever. I was like, yeah.
I'm sorry. Well, I have no desire to
fight. And then the sparkly underpants, he turns out he bought beforehand.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah.
I knew immediately that the rat was Charlie when he started telling stories to help her with her grief or with her thinking through her thought process. Because that's what Charlie would do.
Honestly, I didn't even catch that one.
No, that's what did it for me as well. You jogged my memory.
Yeah, didn't even catch that one. But that is excellent.
Because he would just tell mundane stories and that's what Charlie would do. And I was like, oh, he's the rat.
And he'd find these super mundane details, super interesting. And Tress would love listening to him talk about it. And that was the same thing with the rat. I was like, okay.
That kind of leads into the next question is, so Charlie as a character is not the hero of the story, as would be Wesley and Princess Bride. Charlie has the personality of, I don't know, like, not, I don't know. He's boring. And so Tress is also boring, and that's why they love each other. But Tress goes on this adventure, and she ends up being, you know, it's the damsel in distress saving the prince. What did you think of that little flip and of Tress as the hero?
So I'll say the part in the story where I felt endeared to Charlie was when he was sending her all the cups. And that was his symbol of like he was able to get the princess to not want him. And I thought that was really cute and super endearing. And I just thought that was like such a lovely little detail.
Except that he bored them all to tears and that's how he did it.
So that's funny.
The man weaponized himself. That's great.
I just said the man had no personality.
He weaponized his worst feature. That is a self-aware king. We love it. But anyway, to answer the actual question, I really liked Tress as a main character. I liked that she was like good but practical. I like that she questioned herself and the way she was changing. I also really liked the way that she had ideas for how to solve whatever disasters were going on. A big problem I have in books is when characters are supposed to be super smart, and I feel like they never really show evidence of that. I feel like this book is a really great example of like watching a main character actually have really ingenious ideas that are super creative. Because I do think Fourth Wing is guilty of this, where Violet is like, I have an amazing idea. And I'm like, that is the most obvious thing I've literally ever fucking heard. This book like does it so well. And so that's what made me really like Tress.
She is really ingenious in her own like very subtle way, where she can see things out of the box because she comes from a very mundane life and a mundane lifestyle. She uses that to build upon other people's thoughts. Like when she's being the sporer for the ship, she takes Weave's old journal entries, which are like mad and ingenious all at the same time. And she builds upon them, thinking of them in different ways, where it's just like, what if a cannonball wasn't round? Like, a person who specializes in it would never think of that premise because they're too close to it. And mm-hmm. so I really love that she was so far removed from everything that she could see it from like a 3,000 foot view and just come in and say, "What? Why don't we question the premise, not question the random intricacies?" So I really liked how she came about her hero's journey and how she mm-hmm. thought of things and just how she really managed to use her wits to get out of everything.
My favorite point that comes up, which if you read a lot of fantasy books with bold, brazen heroes in it, it's the point where Hoyt is like, and then she did something that was like the most amazing thing that ever happened. She stopped and thought about it. And you're like, yeah, man, that is so accurate. And like, even her, like everything she was made her plan to get off the island, stopped, reflected on it, rewrote it, didn't hurry, was like, I know I want to save Charlie, but I gotta do it right, you know? And she reflected on every action she made and then used that to make her next step. It didn't just like jump on a friggin' pirate ship and go. And I was like, honestly, it was like, of course, kind of supposed to be funny that was pointed out, but I was like, we need more main characters who like think before they act.
100%. I totally want to retweet that. I feel like I've read like 50 different versions of Katniss Everdeen at this point. And not that we don't love like a brash, brazen woman with anger issues. We love her. But, you know, I also love reading a character who is not that person, but is still strong and independent. Like there's more than one way to be a smart and empowered person.
I would love middle school girls interested in STEM, especially, to read this book.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So one of the main villains, not the ultimate big bad, but one of the obstacles in the book is Captain Crow. And so Captain Crow becomes afraid of Tress because Tress uses hope and love and kindness to get people on her side instead of fear. What did you think about that and how that kind of became part of like the morals that were like woven into the story in a very fairy tale fashion?
This was to the point where I liked the fourth wall break when we kind of almost got into Captain Crow's head through Hoyt, where it's just like, and this is when Captain Crow realized that what she had tried to do this whole time to convince her crew to go to the Crimson Sea with her, this 16-year-old girl, 5 foot nothing, trembling cold, had done in less than a week to convince a crew to love her and to follow her and trust her. And I thought that was a really interesting way of doing it. I also liked that Captain Crow was almost humanized by Tress, because mm-hmm. Tress was so desperately also trying to save her without hurting her, because she was just like, no, this is just a woman who unfortunately has been cursed with the spores and is like this vine monster, essentially, that's like has a ticking time bomb that she's going to die and she needs to be healed. And that's why she'd become so callous, is because she is desperate to find a cure. And so I really liked that Tress was so empathetic and sympathetic throughout the book. It was almost to her detriment at times, but she never gives that up.
First of all, did not see the vine shooting from her face thing coming. That one did catch me off guard and I had to reread.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
I was like, whoa, what?
Yeah.
Literally went back and reread to make sure I got that right, because it happened so fast. But I agreed. That is what I feel like Captain Crow is the character that makes this kind of a fairy tale, because that's how you get all these lessons about just like being a good person. And fairy tales teach you a lesson. And there are a lot of lessons. And then Tress ends up saving her by giving her to the dragon. And you're like, oh.
Okay. That was
so nice.
Favorite parts in the book. When we have no idea, that was one scene in the book where I actually did not know what was going to happen. Like,
oh, yeah.
going down there to meet the dragon, and I was like, I actually don't know what's about to happen here. And then the captain is like, and I present my sacrifice. And Tress is like, I present my sacrifice.
So smart. So smart.
Was it smart or desperate? You know, that's what half of this is like, I don't know. Was it smart?
But, like, or desperate? To be fair, would you have thought of that?
No. I would not have.
I would have been like, all right, guess I'm living with this dragon now, but he seems kind of cool once I met him.
Literally, I was like, okay, if the dragon comes back in a different Cosmere book, I'll read it, because that I am curious about the dragon.
The silver-haired dragon.
Like, well, now that I promoted so-and-so, I need someone else. I was like, this sounds like a fascinating society that I want to be a part of, and I hope Tress goes into it, but she didn't.
Exactly. I mean, he sounds like a boss who would grant, like, paid leave. Maybe she could have rescued Charlie on her time off. I don't know.
Yeah, helped her. I kind of thought that's where it would go, is, like, the dragon was going to end up helping her do that or something. But instead, not only does she save the captain, she gets her three boons for her three friends on the ship. They were, like, the nicest things ever. And you're like, I'm not nearly as good a person as Tress.
Yeah. Would not have thought of that.
Nope. Would not have thought of that either.
So many lessons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Also, when the one lady ended up just needing glasses,
yeah,
she had like some sort of eye disease that made targets super often hurt.
That was so funny. Anyway,
so this is something that we don't see in a lot of fantasy books. There are illustrations in this book. This is also why I thought it was a YA book, because there were illustrations in this book, but they come at random times.
My book only had one illustration at the
very... mine also really? Only had in page illustrations.
Oh my God. I had illustrations throughout in the ebook.
Nope. I had beautiful in pages and like one at the very beginning of Tress.
Oh no. I had full illustrations of the vines coming out of Captain Crow's face. I had illustrations of the Midnight Sea, the Crimson Sea.
I sat here and Googled them when I saw your question, and they're like really cool, but they were not in my hardcover book.
Oh my gosh.
Mine this was the crazy. Same Caitlin. I don't know what these are.
Well, now I'm kind of mad too.
Yeah. I'm like, well, pictures.
Okay, so then I'm going to rephrase my question, because I didn't realize this was only a me thing. So what did you think of the idea of adding illustrations to this book? Would you have liked them to be in there to see the world through an illustrator's eyes, or are you better off without it?
Okay, I didn't mind. Like, I really loved the cover. It made sense reading it. And the end pages were cups, and I really liked the cups. But I like imagining things how I imagine them. It's like, for example, I always think about this. Like, I read Harry Potter and I had a picture of each of the characters in my mind, and now it's forever ruined by what the movies gave me, you know? So like, I don't know. I kind of like just thinking of it myself.
See, I'm the same. I didn't mind the one at the beginning. However, in general, I think that the photos illustrators choose are often a little melodramatic and cheesy. And so I don't tend to like them, just because I don't think that they necessarily encompass the tone of the book. And I want to, like Caitlin, you said, I want to imagine them the way I want to imagine them. I can see in this book, just because it's a world that is like very theoretical, like the very first photo, which is the only photo in my book, which is the one of Tress, that one was a little helpful to have, just because then I knew what to picture for the spores, because those are kind of hard to envision. But I didn't need more photos.
I will say something my book did have that I noticed. There's a little Easter egg. Each chapter heading had like a little design around the number. The design changed with whatever sea she was
I
in.
I noticed that too. I did that, had grow. That too.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So like, it was like the vines, and then it was the spikes, and then it was like the blob and the midnight sea. I was like, wait, what? And
I was like, I had that as well.
That was clever, publishers.
So I normally am on the side of y'all where I don't really love illustrations, because I'm really good at imagining it in my mind, and sometimes that can ruin my perception of things because everyone has different perceptions. I will say these photos were not corny, and they were super interesting to see Captain Crow with the vines coming out of her face. And one I particularly loved was them bartering with the dragon. There was a photo of that. And it's just Tress going, and this is my offering. And then Captain Crow going like that. And the dragon just sitting there like, so.
What's I up, did guys? Google them. I did not see that one. They are really beautiful illustrations. I just, yes. I'm kind of selfish when I read my books.
I'm just going to say I didn't mind them. I thought they kind of added to the experience, but I didn't dissect them super a lot.
You're right. A lot are usually really, really melodramatic. And you're kind of like, eh. But these were really not.
They're more cozy, which yeah. I think matches the vibes. I think the illustrator and the author worked really well together on this one.
My question is, why is the ebook prettier than the physical one?
Yeah, I'm really confused by that. I read a library ebook and it had both the chapter headings that y'all had and illustrations throughout.
I already loaned mine out, so I don't have it now, but I'm kind of mad.
That's crazy that y'all didn't have that. Wow, okay.
Yeah, the reason I didn't read that question when I got to it is because I like actually didn't understand what you were talking
about. Yeah, I left it there because I was curious what you meant.
No, but it totally had illustrations and I just loaned my library book back in, so I can't show you guys.
I believe you because I Googled it while we were talking.
They look anyway, really cool.
One of the illustrations I found is of the friggin' sorceress's spaceship.
Yes, that one was weird.
That leads us to, was the ending satisfactory? I said I was very confused by all the things that happened with Hoid and the sorceress. But otherwise, was it the ending you wanted or thought she deserved?
I mean, I thought Tress deserved it. But it was a very abrupt ending. Like, it was a very drawn out book for a very quick and abrupt ending in the Midnight Sea and the sorceress and Hoid. Like, I felt like we could have developed that ending between Hoid and the sorceress. It was just kind of like, oh, and there we are.
Go on.
I was just going to say, it wasn't too abrupt for me. I agree that like the battle with the sorceress at the end could have been a little more intense. I think the climax could have hit a little harder, but in general, I was honestly pretty happy with the ending. I like that it ended with the sort of happily ever after and that Tress and Charlie were together. I liked that they all got to go home, but I also liked that like she became an adventurer and she ended up deciding to like go back out into the world. So that was kind of the ending I was rooting for.
I like that she's his valet or he's her valet.
I did like, while the sorceress stuff confused me, the part where she returns to the rock and like gives the Duke his what for and brings her family with her and like gets her new ship and stuff. Like that is everything I wanted in a fairy tale ending. It was a little, I did think, I was like, oh man, Charlie's just going to be a rat friend now. And then Hoid's like, I changed these two words and he was magically okay. I was like, okay, I guess. But the rest of it, I really liked.
That was a lot.
Sorry, this just popped into my head. We haven't even talked about my favorite character, Ulam.
Oh my God, the zombie.
I don't even know how to talk about him because what?
He's so, a zombie dude from an
I was trying
planet.
To buy her body parts. Very
yeah, she's like, after you die, can I have your eyes? And she's like, no.
Personally, you need an extra ear.
I imagined him as a vampire. And,
me too.
You know, this like dead thing without a soul that has like a great sense of humor and it's immortal and he like solves all these diseases. To me, he was the perfect mix of creepy and good natured that I thought his scene.
Well, and you never understand why it's like Hoid summons him. A, how does idiot summon him? B, now he's just chilling on this planet for like a year on the ship being a doctor. And you're like, what? Bro, I have questions about Ulam.
The line where it talks about the captain shooting him and he just doesn't die. And so they just accept that he's there, like, made me laugh.
Well, from my understanding, my reading is Hoid summons him before he is cursed, like sends him a letter, and that's why he comes, and then he sees them after he is cursed. But the part where I was laughing and giggling is I totally believe Ulam could have solved this curse well before Tress did.
Oh, he alludes at the end that he totally could have.
Yeah, he purposely didn't just to hold ammunition over Hoyt and all the stupid things he was saying and writing them in a book. And I was like, that is so funny.
When he
funny.
Turned off his ears for the poem, I was like, stop. See, you did like the funny shit sometimes, Catherine.
I liked Ulam. I will totally agree with that. I liked that.
Ulam comes with Hoyt.
But Ulam's more fun than Hoyt.
Yeah, Ulam is more fun.
Here's a question, since we're talking about that. We kind of already talked about the end, but this is found family to the max and the weirdest friggin' found family we have ever read. We typically love found family. What was your reaction to this one?
I liked it.
I still love it. Yeah.
Yeah.
No probs.
I liked Soleil. I liked Fort. And I liked his little board. I was crushed when Captain Crow crushed his board.
Yeah.
I was emotionally crushed by that. Because I was like, oh my God, this poor man who's deaf and just wants to live and exist in the world without lip reading. And he has this magical board and Captain Crow chose to humiliate him by that.
You find out it's not a magical board. It's basically a freaking iPad that they're using to spy on people.
That was a little much. That was a little much. that part lost me a bit, I will say, when we find out it's just an iPad, essentially. I liked the characters a lot in this book that weren't Hoyt. Hoyt I had problems with. The narrator particularly. But I liked Soleil, I liked Fort, and I liked Anne. Although Anne and her eye issues, I was all kind of just like, and she's just like, I just like them because they're fun. I like guns because they're fun. I was like, huh?
Oh no, that was the one adult joke in there. Did you catch it?
Yeah, I did. But
yeah, I loved it. I loved the side characters. I thought they were all cute and were in the book the perfect amount. So one of our last questions, did this book intrigue you enough to read other books in this universe?
I mean, obviously for me, no.
I'm intrigued because I actually do like the funny writing style. However, I'm still intimidated because there are so many. I think maybe once he comes out with the book or books that are Hoyt's backstory, I would pick it up because now I'm so freaking curious and want to know more about him and Ulam. I'm still intimidated by the rest of Brandon Sanderson's body of work.
Yes. I have heard, based on the reviews, that some of his other books are more serious. And so I don't know if that is something I would like as much. I think I could use a little extra push still. Like, if you guys have a book by him you really want us to read and you drop it in our DMs, you know, I would be happy to do so, but on my own, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if I'll end up doing it.
Other question. So we know he has written middle grade books. This reads sort of like we said, anyone could pick it up. Would you classify this as YA or keep it on the adult list with most of the rest of his books and the rest of the Cosmere?
I mean, I've already said that I thought it was YA throughout all of it. There are parts, I will say, they use a lot of big ass words in this book, especially like Ulam and Hoyt, where it's like superfluous and capricious. And like, so if you're a middle schooler or a high schooler, it may take a minute to just figure out what the words mean, because I'm 24 and I was like thrown off a bit and jarred. But the story itself, I think, is pretty YA. And there's not a lot of like smut that you would think in normal fantasy or sci-fi that would classify it as adult. So I think it's just wording and verbiage that might push it a little bit more. But I think it is YA.
I do think, I stand by that I think anyone could read this. I think non-adults would miss a good chunk of the satire in some of the jokes. Like little quippy comments just about how people act in life that I just think you have to have lived a little bit longer to catch the satire.
That's like the same as Shrek.
I mean, fair, yeah. Anyone can watch it. You're not going to get the satire, though.
That is basically what I was about to say. So, like, I was going to say, to me, this is like a Disney movie where Disney is really good about making movies that children enjoy, but that actually also have a lot of adult jokes mixed in, and you're just a child, so you literally don't even know they're happening. But, like, Disney a lot of times approaches movies with the concept of, like, we want children to, like, love this movie, but we also want parents to be willing to watch it, and so we kind of intersperse different levels of humor. I feel like this book kind of did that. For me, the thing that actually might push it out of middle grade for sure and into like older YA is, like, I don't think pre-college I would have understood the spores thing. Like, I hate to like out myself a little bit, but the like actual like basis of the world is like more complicated than I think most like YA magic systems.
That's fair.
Well, it's basically just a planet of mold.
I would not have gotten it.
It falls from the moons and there's creatures. Yeah.
Are these sparkles? Does spore mean the same thing as sparkle?
I do. I think if you're reading it at middle grade, you're thinking, oh, fairy tale and pirates. And you're reading it as an adult and you're getting probably a deeper meaning.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
I agree.
I don't know if I'd reclassify it as YA, but I could certainly see the argument.
I think it's, if you are like us and you were probably an early reader and always reading advanced of your age, I think this is a book that parents can safely give to their kids as a foray into adult fantasy without worrying.
Little Casey, Catherine, and Caitlin probably would have loved this as middle schoolers.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. I would have loved it.
I think I would have given it more stars if I was younger.
That brings us, so book recommendations is what we talk about next. So I want to re-bring up his series, Alcatraz versus the Evil Librarians. I think I read four or five of them when I was in middle school. It is a similar concept. There are these different types of sand, and the sand can be melded into different types of glass for lenses you look through or use in other ways. So similar concept to the spores thing. So if you liked the just kind of funny, quippy, easy read with that concept, just read the middle grade books.
So my recommendation, before anyone else says it, I said it earlier in this episode, it's Six Crimson Cranes. That is another cozy fantasy. That book is definitely YA, but like, I still enjoyed it. And I thought that was one of my favorite reads last year. Just because it was such a great fairy tale inspired story.
The main character is basically Tress.
Yeah, Tress, but like a little bit more bumbling and a little bit more vapid. Not vapid in a bad way, but just
a little bit spicier too. Like, yeah. She's kind of, I don't know, a little more sharp around the edges.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't read a lot of books like this.
Well, who does?
Well, I don't even read a lot of sci-fi, so I can't even say like I'm in within genre. I kind of want to give two recommendations that we read for the podcast and one I've already mentioned before.
Do not say Gideon the Ninth.
No, I wasn't going to say Gideon the Ninth. There is nothing similar to Gideon the Ninth.
Other than different for that planets. It's in a planet. No.
Yes. No, I was not going to say Gideon the Ninth. I was actually going to say Divine Rivals.
Oh, okay.
And I think it has a similar vibe almost in the sense of like a girl from a very small life, finding a bigger purpose and finding a bigger story, getting out of her own life. It's a lot of journey based. It's not very similar, but I think in world building, it has some similarities. And then also One Dark Window, which has been all over Book Talk actually recently. Twisted Crowns, I think, is the second one that just came out. And I think the world building is very similar to this one, where it's a completely different world. It's more medieval in a sense, but it has this idea of tarot cards that can control people and powers that are kept hidden. And rich people definitely capitalize on these tarot cards and usurp them up to kind of control others. And it's an interesting read, and like it very much so follows a girl with special talents and special abilities that has to keep them secret, and then meets like a guy and meets, it's female driven, female power. We love it. That's all I read. Let's be real.
Girl yeah. fantasy.
Girl fantasy.
Hell yeah. Okay. So that brings us to the end of our episode. Please rate and review. These are just our opinions. We love to hear from you guys. If you have books you want us to read, or you want to yell at us for the things we said in this episode, we'd love to yell back. And you can find us at Busy Girls Pod.
Yeah. If you're a Brandon Sanderson fan, tell us. Like, I feel like this is probably among his fans, like a debate, like Star Wars, like what order to watch them in. What order would you recommend reading them in? And maybe we can share it for anyone who is like, where do I start? So, slide into our DMs. With that, I'm Caitlin.
I'm Casey.
And I'm Catherine. Thanks for listening. And when you get a chance, take a break with the Busy Girls Book Club.